Well, welcome to the Boundless Roundtable. My name is Lisa Anderson, and I have a cold.
All right. Looking good, Lisa.
Thank you. No, actually, this is Leon Worth sitting in for Lisa Anderson, hoping that the aura from the microphone at which she normally sits for these things is rubbing off on me. I am your host this week for the Roundtable, and with me in studio is Nathan, Mike, and Jesse. And we're going to introduce those guys in just a minute, but today, guys, we want to talk a bit about preparing for family leadership and what that means when we're in our 20s, what that means when we're looking back a little bit and thinking about the things that we've learned and the things that we're still learning. So why don't we go ahead and go through the room here and tell us a little bit about how long you've been married and a little bit about yourselves.
Well, I'm Jesse, and I've been a focus on the family here 19 years, mainly working in the kids area. So this is fun to actually talk as an adult. I'm very excited about today. I've been married for 22 years. And actually, now my kids, they tell me they're adults because now I have a 19-year-old and an 18-year-old. And wow. So I've been through a lot with the family and excited about being on the round table today.
Great.
I'm Nathan Pyle. Been on the round table a few times, a couple different topics. I'm assistant producer with the broadcast team. Here at Focus, been married a month and a week wow. as of this taping. So very new to the process, but also very excited about it.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm Mike. You guys probably recognize my voice a bit. I've been on Boundless Show a few times. I work in the broadcasting department here at Focus. I've been married for almost a year and a half, and actually we're expecting our first awesome. In February.
That is awesome.
All right. Yeah. Congratulations. Way
yeah.
to go.
Yeah.
And I, for all of you wondering about me, I have been married to my wonderful wife, Michelle, for 19 years. Today, while we're in the studio recording this, is our anniversary, our 19th anniversary. And some of you may recall from my previous appearances on the podcast, we have 8 daughters. And so we have a very interesting household, as you can imagine. Well, guys, let's jump right into it. Author Dr. Meg Jay says, in some of the PR for her new book, The Defining Decade, she says, like it or not, your 20s define your adult life. Doing something later is not automatically the same thing as doing something better. 30 is not the new 20. And I think the main thing that she's saying is that the 20s is a very important decade where the trajectory of our life is really being set. And whether we're getting married in our early 20s, in our late 20s, 30s, whatever, there's a lot that's really going on in our lives and setting us forward. And for us guys, I think we're learning a lot about what it means to be a man, what it means to prepare for marriage, to prepare for being a father someday. Tell me a little bit about what some of you experienced in kind of coming up in and through the 20s and wrestling with those questions of what does it mean to be a man and am I ready for that?
Well, I got married when I was 20, actually. So my 20s were, as I was trying to figure out what it meant to be a man, I was also figuring out what it meant to be a husband. And we had our first child when I was 22. And so it was sort of what's it like to be a dad. So it was kind of just, you know, jumping into the deep end of the pool in a lot of ways. But when I met, you know, Stephanie and we fell in love and I knew this is the person I wanted to spend my life with, I wanted that part of my life to start as soon as possible. So I was, after my sophomore year of college, we got married and she sort of helped support me through the end of college and through grad school. And but a lot of it was, you know, wrestling with those issues about what it means to be the head of the household
right.
and all those things. And being, I was at Wheaton College, so I was taking all the New Testament classes. I was taking a marriage in the Bible. What does that mean? And what was so cool is I actually brought my wife into that class. And so we sat in there together. She didn't go to Wheaton, but she sat in that class with me. So we actually took a semester long, what does marriage look like in the Bible class to help us grow together and be together. But, yeah, there were some mistakes made in there, but at the same time, we were deeply committed to each other, and I think that was the most important thing is, you know, a man follows through on his commitments. That was probably one of the first things I learned in my 20s is that, you know, we're going to make this thing work.
Yeah, and I got married in my late 20s, and I think the unfortunate thing, first of all, I think I just need to say, I think I failed at properly preparing to be a leader, and I think most guys to some extent would say that once they are married and they're looking back. But got married in the late 20s, and I had established a lot of these single man habits, routines, in terms of like how I spent my money, how I spent my free time,
right.
Stuff like that. And I think had I gotten married in my early 20s, like you, Jesse, that I think some of those habits wouldn't have been established. They would have been established as a married couple.
As a couple, yeah.
But unfortunately, and we can eventually get into that stuff, yeah, finances and mm-hmm. how I spend my time. Yeah, just I had a lot of growing to do. I did that in my mid-20s and then got married, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel the same way Mike does, and the same thing. I got married at 30, age 30, like 2 months after my 30th birthday, and a lot of those habits were ingrained, that independence, that right. do what I want with my money. Now I come home to a household where she checks the bank account every night mm-hmm. online, and she sees every transaction, and it's a whole another level of accountability, and I think, wow, I have to be accountable for a lot of that. And I remember I was in a wedding after I got married, about a month after I got married, I was in a wedding, and I was telling one of the other groomsmen that I speak for two now. I'm a voice for two now. She's taken my name.
Mm-hmm.
She honors my name by willingly going into this union saying, I trust Nathan. I trust what he says. I trust what he does. And as I was telling this friend that, I thought, well, I'm giving him some advice, when I had no idea really the weight of that until it left my lips.
Right.
You know, but as far as preparing, I remember my friends getting married starting at age 23. And a couple of year after that, on the clock, just 23, 24 was two more got married, 25, yeah. two mm-hmm. more got married. And as they added up, I began to see all the different types of relationships, mm-hmm. how they were healthy, how they were unique mm-hmm. in their own ways. Some were godly, some weren't. But they each had their pros and cons, things that I wanted to see modeled in my own marriage, and things that I didn't and could learn from. So
mm-hmm.
Just witnessing that in your own friend circle and family circle was important.
You know, you bring up modeling, and I know for me, I grew up in a broken home, divorce, remarriage, divorce again, remarriage. Mm-hmm. Jesse, I know you have some brokenness in your past. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but... I really found a lot of the lessons I was looking for about what it would mean to be a good dad, a good husband, in part by observing families around me, men around me that I respected. I knew they weren't perfect. I was close enough to them to see some of the warts of their family existence and whatnot. But that really was a big thing for me growing up that I think not only was instructive to me, but gave me some hope. But tell me a little bit, what were some of the ways that you guys were building up in your minds a sense of what it means to be a man and what your expectations were going to be once you finally got to the altar and said, I do, and took the weight of that on?
Yeah, some of you listeners may remember my father passed away just over 10 years ago, so back when I was 19. And so in that critical time of my life when I was really stepping into, hey, I want to pursue marriage, I want to find a woman, that kind of thing, I lacked that father figure for myself. However, the Lord was faithful. He brought men around me that were in different stages, you know, the newly married men or the men that had been married 10, 20, 30 years, and even grandfather type dads as well. But I remember, and I think I've shared this story before, one specific mentor, he was just telling us kind of like, you know, when it comes to the marriage duties, kind of those routines of life, he was telling me, you know, don't over-spiritualize things. If the dishes need to be unloaded, just do the dishes. It's not because mm-hmm. you want to do this act of, oh, honey, I want to love you and I want to show my love for you. I'm going to do the dishes. No, the dishes need to be done, so you do them. And so something simple like that, I think there have been a lot of situations in the last year and a half
mm-hmm.
where that small picture have kind of played out. And I don't think it's just giving into every need and want that your wife or your family may have, but there's an element of you lay aside what you're doing to serve your family, and that may look like doing the dishes when you really want to be out in the garage, or it may mean how you spend your money and your time as well.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of guys it's kind of a rough awakening, especially when you come from a single environment, because suddenly your guy friends don't want to do things You can't really have that availability, and you have to make your marriage a priority. And I saw that modeled in a lot of my friends too. Man, I'd love to hang out with you, but I'm doing this tonight. Mm-hmm. And on the other end of that, you may be quick to say, "Oh, you're just letting me down again, man. You're just always unavailable," which isn't true at all when you really look at it. But they prioritize that way. And probably the best lesson I got from a married man who was about my age, a couple years older, is he said, "You have to see her perspective." And I said, "Well, what do you mean? Give me an example." And he's like, "When her car breaks down and you say, 'I'll be there in a minute,' and you can go and pick her up and you can save her from that, that's fine. But she's still stranded for that amount of time and worried about what's next. So it's not that you're there and you can come grab her at any moment and she has to worry about her car doing something. It's that period of time that you're not there. You have to see it from that kind of perspective." And he said, "See everything from how she would see things."
Finding somebody who can speak into your life, like the mentor you're talking about, because I did have a similar growing up experience as you did, Leon. You know, my mom divorced and remarried twice when I was growing up, and my college roommate, he was actually just out here last week, and we were talking about it because he was the one I was living with him as I was engaged and getting ready to be married, and he was in the wedding and stuff after our sophomore year of college, and he was saying, "With your background, you were looking for some stability in your family, and once you found that, you wanted to latch onto it because we didn't have the role models in our parents, and I think a lot of kids are kind of there. They look at their parents who have been divorced. What we did have is we had wonderful role models in our grandparents. In fact, if you go to our house, there's a picture. There's five. It's a frame with five pictures in it. And my wife and I are in the middle. And then we have her two sets of grandparents above us and my two sets of grandparents below us, all of whom were married over 50 years, had wonderful marriages, and were people who we looked to as sort of that spiritual role model as what a godly marriage looks like. And I just praise God that we had those godly grandparents to sort of look to and kind of were our mentors in the early years of our marriage.
Yeah. Those are priceless models for all of us. I know my grandparents, my mom's parents, were also a huge inspiration to me. And I learned so much from them. You know, you mentioned that sense of stability and kind of latching onto that sense of security. I know that to me was a big part of, okay, I am now married, and no matter what has come before, I'm going to make this work. And I was surprised at when I was first married at how insecure I was. You know, I wound up realizing pretty quickly that I craved that stability and security so much that I was putting a lot of pressure on Michelle without her even knowing it, that how she responded to me either made me feel like a million bucks or it scared the living daylights out of me, because I thought, it's all going to fall apart. I'm not doing this well, whatever. And so I remember one of my surprises was how much I was really relying on her for my sense of security, for my sense of identity. And that was something that I really had to wrestle through with and kind of transcend in my identity and relationship and security being in God first, instead of putting that on Michelle. What were some of the other surprises that some of you guys had as you were stepping into marriage and the responsibility of being a husband and perhaps of being a dad as well, that took you by surprise? You were like, "Wow, I didn't realize it was going to be like this," or "I didn't realize that I was going to wrestle with this."
I'd say one of the biggest surprises for me is I'm not dating her anymore, meaning the night doesn't end at 10 and I say goodbye and we part ways. And I could just talk about what I did right and what I did wrong and think about that. It doesn't end that way. It's a continuous flowing process. And if it ended on a bad note, it doesn't end. It keeps going on a bad note. And you've got to correct that. And that was a huge shock to me, because I was really good at dating and I was really bad at loving. And I was like, I could take her on a great date and have all this fun time and kind of be fun, Nathan. But when it came time to maybe something she wanted to talk about or she was hurt about, I just kind of pat her on the shoulder. Yeah, it'll be okay, champ. I don't really know what to do here. I don't have an exit plan. And that really, really rocked my world, because I realized I can't turn away from her now. I vowed to be here. And I don't know why it took me for such a surprise, because I knew that going in, but when you're actually living it, it's different.
I think just the whole idea of what it means to be a leader in a family. you know, I had three different dads growing up, so I got to see some different styles in what it means to lead a family. And sometimes that was very dictatorial and dogmatic in mm-hmm. what it meant. And I think that's sort of how I sort of approached it initially, until you realize that really that's not your job necessarily. Your job is to, I don't know, maybe more of a coach, like bring out the best, the talents, the giftings that God has given them, and nurture those things in your family. That's really what it means to be a leader. You don't necessarily have to set the agenda and we're going this way and here's our plan, right. Step in line, lock toe. You know, it's not that kind of thing. It's more of a being example and understanding the wishes and wants and getting everybody, you know, sort of working together that way. Was a big lesson for me.
Right.
I think to go along with that, Jesse, the weight, or in premarital counseling, what we went over was, you know, the just as Christ loves the church, lays his life down for the church, we as the husbands are to lay our lives down for our family, for our wives and our children. Mm-hmm. And I think the weight of that really sank in once I got married, like, oh my goodness, you know, okay, so how did Christ lay his life down for the church? And then just seeing that play out in all situations when it came to conflict, when it came to finances and, you know, wanting to lead your family and wanting to draw out of them these personalities or these giftings and these skills and stuff. So, yeah, once marriage hit, like looking at, oh my goodness, this is overwhelming, but I can't do this without Christ. Mm-hmm. Like, right. Yes, I'm reflecting Christ to my family, but I need to be following Christ myself.
Loving your bride as Christ loved the church. I'm convinced that that one statement in Scripture holds men to a higher standard than it does for our wives about our level of commitment. The lengths that we should be willing to go to.
Yeah.
You know, what if your wife someday is unfaithful to you? What if she wants to end a marriage? I mean, there's no wiggle room in there, is there? I mean, Christ pursued us when we were faithless as the church, when we were his enemy, when we rejected him, he continued to pursue us and to love us and to lay down his life for us. That is an amazing and very, very high bar. I think it leads me to another lesson I remember coming across, and that is just realizing how self-centered I am.
Yeah.
And that's part of the, I think, sanctification process of marriage, isn't it? Gary Thomas, I think, says something along the lines of, what if marriage isn't just to make us happy, but to make us holy, to sanctify us, to refine us? And a dear friend of mine who's an older man who's been married a long time, he said, you know, I thought I was doing really good, walking well with the Lord before I got married. And then being newly married opened up my eyes to just how self-centered I was. And then I thought I was doing pretty good and kind of adjusting to that. And then kids came along. Mm-hmm. And then I really realized how really, really self-centered I was. Okay. But these are all part of the refining process. You know, we've also got a lot of young ladies who are listening as well. And as they're thinking, they're hearing our stories and they're hearing our struggles, and they might be thinking about what should my level of expectation be as I'm thinking about what kind of a leader I'm looking for in a potential future husband. What would you guys say as advice for the women in the audience about what to be looking for in someone who will be a strong leader?
I think just something that quickly comes to mind, Alistair Begg, and I think we've actually got a focused broadcast coming up about this. He actually shares about how when you're looking for a spouse, if you're a young lady looking for a young man, observe how he treats his mother, how he treats his siblings, and those that are maybe kind of the down and out of society around you. And that doesn't require talking or like late night coffee conversations where the guy can just spill all this stuff. Those are simple, like, I'm standing in the back of the room watching the way that he treats these people. Mm. And that speaks a lot about his character and even his willingness to be refined as a single man. Mm-hmm. Because I think to just jump on something earlier, we have to remember that this sanctification process isn't reserved just for marriage. Like, this has to take place as a single person as well.
Right.
So hopefully that's taking place in that guy's life.
Yeah.
I'd say just finding a man that's, you know, committed to his faith, to being part of a body of believers who is willing to be accountable for his actions. I mean, as I look at, you know, my daughter who, you know, turns 18, you know, that's, I was married 2 years after this age. So
right.
Those are the questions I'm asking her when we're going out. I'm saying, okay, so what are you looking for in the guys that you date? And sort of having her sort of have some expectations in mind because, yeah, there can be some great smooth-talking guys who treat you nicely and buy you nice things and sort of know how to treat a woman. But unless their relationship with the Lord is right, unless they're walking with him, there's just not the foundation that that relationship's going to need to go long-term.
Right.
Yeah. I'd say one of the biggest things to look for along the lines of character is how does he handle conflict with you being the girl and with his family, with other people? What's his public face like versus his private face? And along the lines of conflict, is he able to empathize? Is he able to get in the shoes of the person he's conflicting with and see it from that perspective? Or is he just trying to bring a conflict around to an area where he can fight better? You know, is he trying to bring it into his corner where he knows every nook and cranny of it and then he can run circles? Or is he trying to bring it out in the open and be neutral about it? And that's a leadership quality, too, I think, that is comes with leading, is you're able to bring something out into the open, talk about it in a way that doesn't get emotions riled up and works through an issue.
That's such a great point, how you handle conflict. I mean, in my own life, this is a problem that I have is I'm competitive. I mean, I'd love to win. Throw me on the basketball court. I mean, I'm over 40 years old, and you know, I'll still dive for a ball. You know,
right.
I'm just that competitive. But you get that way as a man.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you're arguing with your wife, like you just want to win.
Right.
You know, winning an argument is losing in a relationship sometimes, you know, and certainly there's times where you have to stand up for a point of view and argue something out. But to win an argument just for the sake of winning, which I know some guys can get into the habit of, you know, they just are just so competitive, just sort of letting that go. And as you were saying, really discussing it, talking it out, you know, being a good listener, that is so important in conflict, is having a guy actually listen and hear what his wife is saying instead of talking over her and trying to win this argument.
And does he create an environment where you can bring those things up to him?
Right.
If you're asking yourself, well, I'm going to talk to him about this when he's in a better mood. Then that's the wrong thought to have, because you want to be able to say, I want my husband to be the same guy at midnight that he is at noon.
Right. And I think all of this actually is, these examples are the fruit of the Spirit. Like, it goes off, Jesse, what you're saying, that, you know, look for the guy that has that relationship with the Lord, and the fruit of the Spirit will pour out of him. So if you're observing him, if you're interacting with him, conflict, the way he's kind to others, like, that stuff should be visible. And if it isn't, then maybe question that.
Right. Well, one final thought on that would be, you know, if he messes up, does he fess up? You know, I think I know for my daughters, as they're getting older now, and some of them are getting closer and closer to that age as well. Our oldest turned 16 in just a few days. You know, I certainly want them to really put stock in a man who is willing to say, I messed up, I'm sorry, who has a repentant heart, who's willing not to be defensive about things that come up. I mean, we all know it in marriage. You can't hide who you really are. And so the worst of you is going to come out at some point in time. Do you react defensively, or do you react in a way that says, you know what, I want God to rule in my heart and life. I want to make a change here. And I think that's a quality that I certainly want for my daughters as well. Mm-hmm. Well, guys, this has been a great conversation, and I really appreciate your time today. I think just a quick closing thought for all of our listeners is something that hit me as we were thinking about this topic and preparing for today, is that the reality is that every marriage is a step of faith, isn't it? Because no matter how well you think you know a person, you have so much more to discover. And unfortunately, a lot of that discovery happens after you've already said, I do, or I will. Every marriage is a step of faith. But I think, you know, if we can remember that we have to ask ourselves, a step of faith in what or in whom? You know, we can't just put all of our faith in our spouse or our potential spouse. We have to put some faith, all our faith, really, in the Lord and let him lead us and guide us and keep our hearts soft, not only toward him as he's molding and shaping us, but really toward our spouse as we are refined and sanctified through that process. And I think that is what lays that foundation mm-hmm. then for us to be the men that God is calling us to be. So, hey guys, thanks a lot for joining us on this roundtable. We hope this is a blessing to all of you who are listening, and may God bless you as you're on your journey.
Very privileged this week to have for our culture segment on the show, Dr. Meg J. Meg, welcome.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
Very fun to have you. We love when we can find folks out there who are kind of saying something that resonates with our audience and with our message here at Boundless, but maybe sometimes from a different kind of source. And Meg mm-hmm. has written a book, The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. And who knows that we always talk about stuff about people in their 20s here on the show. We're trying to help you 20-somethings. Come on. So Meg is in the fray with us on this one. So we're excited that she has come out with this book. Meg is assistant clinical professor at the University of Virginia. I did confirm on the front end that she knows Brad Wilcox and some of the guys over there. We've had Brad on the show as well, and got her doctorate in clinical psychology from UC Berkeley, I think, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So you've kind of been around and about and certainly have looked at this subject for an extended period of time. And I know it was very, you interviewed a lot of 20-somethings to kind of get some perspective on that. And so we're just excited to delve into some of these topics with you, Meg.
Great. Fire away.
Okay. Well, I want to know first off, because this was one of the really interesting things that you had to say from the get-go with the book, and you claim that the 20s are the critical period of adulthood. So no one in our audience is probably going to say that they've heard that before necessarily.
Right.
You know, we always think of it as a training ground, as just
right.
a launching pad, as blah, blah, blah. But
right.
you're saying right out the gate, we need to get serious. And so can you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. And that's why the title of the book is The Defining Decade. It's about the fact that what you do during your 20s will define your adult life to come. We know that 80% of life's most defining moments happen by the age of 35. 70% of lifetime wage growth happens in the first 10 years of a career. More than half of us are married or are dating or living with our partner by 30. Most people don't know this, but our personalities can change more in our 20s than any time before or after. Female fertility peaks at 28, and even the brain caps off its last major growth spurt in our 20s. So our 20s are a time when the things that we do and even all the things that we don't do are going to have an enormous impact across years and even generations to come.
Yeah. Well, as I talked to some of my friends about this, they basically just got massively depressed because they're like, oh, my goodness, what have I squandered?
And well,
I
know, let me guess. Or were they the 28 or the 29-year-old?
They were.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So good.
And
so
some early 30s, too.
Yeah. So I'm glad you raised that because it's funny. When I was writing this or been talking about it on the radio, people would say, oh, well, a 20 or 21-year-old, that they're too young to hear this. This is too much pressure. And then the 28 or the 29-year-old, they say, I'm too old to hear this. I've blown it. But the point of the book is that your 20s are such a developmental sweet spot. It's a time if you change one aspect of your life, even a little bit, that can make an enormous difference in 2 or 5 or 10 years. So it's not too late for 29-year-olds. I'll even say it's not too late for 31-year-olds, of course. The point is that young adulthood is such a pivotal time when it's really whatever it is you want to change about yourself or get going in your life, it will never be easier than it is in your 20s.
Yeah. Well, you talk about something in the book that you define as identity capital.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to us kind of what that is? And then how can a 20-something intentionally craft their identity, really, you know, getting started where they feel like maybe they're just being carried along by what opportunities given them, but you're saying they can be much more intentional about it?
Yes. I think identity capital has actually never been more important to understand than it is now, especially with the bad economy. So identity capital is a sociological concept. It's not my term. It's one I'm introducing to 20-somethings. But it's about rather than spending your 20s having an identity crisis, meaning sitting around wondering what you should do and going to see psychics and, you know, best friends and therapists about it. And I'm a therapist, and I say rather than sit around and wonder what you should do, go out and do some things and be sure that these, whatever you do in work or hobbies, that it has something called identity capital, which is something that adds value to your resume or to the development of yourself. It's the kind of thing that you do where when you talk to someone, they say, oh, tell me more about that, or it makes you more relevant to the next thing that you want to do. And I think too many 20-somethings sort of hear, figure out who you want to be and then go get started. But it's very difficult to start without some identity capital. So examples are, I had a client I talk about in the book, but she was a client of mine a few years ago, that she couldn't decide whether she should work in a coffee shop or go be, you know, a very low-rung member of a quite well-known company. And obviously, the choice to me was that she needed to go be a low-rung worker at this well-known company because that company has a lot, it would give her a lot of identity capital. People would say, oh, you worked there, tell me about that, and that will just open more doors. Right now, because the economy is so poor, many 20-somethings are underemployed, so it's important to realize that not all underemployment is the same. A not-so-great job with lots of identity capital will get you somewhere someday. A not-so-great job without identity capital is going to keep you stuck.
That's good. I would say, and a lot of our listeners know this, that I tend to trend on the side of being a risk taker. And now I'm a decade behind, so I did float through my 20s, didn't know what I was doing, did a lot of temping, was all over the map, moved all over the country. And then really when I hit like 28, 29, I was like, I need to get my business together and
right.
figure out what I'm doing.
Exactly. So, and that's, I mean, you're really speaking to that point of, it's the defining decade, meaning a lot of people have a moment at 28 or 29 where they really kick it into gear and they can jumpstart some really great lives. It's not the defining first year or two out of college that, mm-hmm. you know, these things will happen at different times for people, but it's very difficult to jumpstart a career, find a partner, have a family, and do all that in time if you're starting everything at 35.
Yeah. So I would say I was more of like the risk taker type when I finally figured out, you know what, I need to take hold of some opportunities that are in front of me. But what would you say, Meg, what's a good balance between risk and reality for a 20-something? Because, you know, we see a lot of 20-somethings that will err on the other side of just being these dreamers that are only going to do these big things, and they're waiting for that next big thing, but they're not willing to earn their stripes in the meantime.
Right. Huh, a good balance of risk and reality. Well, I mean, I think it's nice to think about those. It's like thinking about crisis and capital. It's great to think about what do I want to do with my life? What do I want to be? What are my dreams? But at the end of the day, you have to do the math. It has to add up in terms of, can I pay my rent? Is this going to add up for me time-wise, is this even making me happy? I have clients who've managed to get themselves amazing jobs that they dreamed they would have, yet they hate them and they're miserable. And so they took a lot of risks in their career that now they feel like they need to be more realistic about. If I can't really work at this pace for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one example you give, I know in the book is talking about social media, specifically Facebook, and how we kind of use that as a measuring stick of our worth compared to other people, and how we really craft these pseudo identities that probably aren't a true reflection of where we are. And what do you think? I mean, even sitting on Facebook, and I spend a lot of time on Facebook, so maybe I need to reevaluate here, but I do see us kind of wasting time pretending or almost dreaming about a life that we don't have, rather than living the one that we do have.
Absolutely. It's so interesting, Lisa, because I've been working with 20-somethings a long time, and you know, my generation also wandered. So none of this is new to me, but the newest thing to come along in my sessions in the last few years is Facebook, in that this is a completely new stress and press on 20-somethings. You would be stunned to know the number of hours a week I spend hearing about Facebook, talking with people about Facebook, that people, you know, come in and they say, oh my gosh, I was up all night looking at everybody's lives and everyone looked like they had the perfect life and what's wrong with me. And probably the best comparison is when you compare your real body to the cover of Sports Illustrated. Mm-hmm. It's not a fair comparison, because we know that what people put on Facebook is crafted and airbrushed and edited, and it's just not, it sets you up for an upward social comparison where your life feels low compared to what everyone else is doing. But it's just not the whole story.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you say, really, you talk too about the power of, I think you have a section in the book called Weak Ties, where you talk about what most people would define as some version of networking.
Networking, yeah, absolutely.
And what that means, and how kind of how reluctant we are to do that. But really, there's so much mobility that can come out of that.
Yes, and it was the strength of weak ties. That's another sociologist. That's Mark Granovetter. And again, I really wanted to educate and empower 20-somethings by teaching them about his work, partly because everybody rolls their eyes at the word networking. Mm-hmm. And the strength
it's
of
like
weak
mentorship.
Ties.
It's another one people roll their eyes at.
Yes, and everybody, it's the strength of weak ties is such a more interesting concept in a way, but it's about how the people we know the least well will be the ones who are most transformative in our lives, because our closest friends and family, that tends to be a homogeneous group. We all think alike. We've got the same ideas. We've had the same conversations a million times. But it's going to be that aunt's neighbor or the roommate from college's cousin. It's going to be people who are outside the inner circle who let us know about new information and new opportunities. And I can tell you, not a single one of my clients is unemployed. I would not have it any other way. And they all have gotten their jobs through the strength of weak ties. And none of them want to call people up and ask for favors or send emails to an old professor's colleague that they heard about, but that's how people are getting their jobs. And 20-somethings who won't do it just can't catch up to the 20-somethings who are smart enough to make use of those weak ties.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's just quickly move in the direction of relationships, because you definitely apply this to relationships as well, saying specifically that we don't have to think that we can only choose our friends. We really do choose our families as well. And
right.
I think the area of relationships is something where 20-somethings just throw up their hands and say, oh, that's totally fate. If it happens, it happens. I just don't know. I mean, I know it worked for Sex and the City, but what, So talk to us a little bit about how young adults can really take hold of their romantic relationships in general, and move forward in them.
Well, I talk about in the defining decade that phrase that you hear people, especially 20-somethings, say a lot. Usually when they're lamenting about their parents, they say, well, you can't pick your family, but you can pick your friends. Mm-hmm. And our 20s are dominated by our friends, and our friends are supportive and helpful and wonderful, but this emphasis on friends causes 20-somethings to sometimes lose sight of the fact that they're about to pick their families, that they are about to choose partners, choose their partners' families, decide the shape and size and timing of their own families in terms of parenthood. And not enough 20-somethings are pointed toward this soon enough. Not that they need to do it all at 25 or at 28, but it takes quite a bit of time to learn how to have a good relationship. What kind of person do I want to be with? When might I want to settle down? How old do I want to be when I have that first child and that last child? This takes a lot of forward thinking that a lot of 20-somethings, or especially 30-somethings, then say, I wish someone had made me take myself a little bit more seriously sooner. We kind of hear our 20s are for having a good time, and a lot of 20-somethings think, well, I don't need to worry about marriage. I'm not going to get married till I'm in my 30s. But then they turn 30, and they really start to panic. And it's like that they miss some time where they could have been practicing and really thinking about what they want.
Yeah, well, then it's like they, so many also focus on those friendships in their 20s and then realize once they're in their 30s that a lot of their friends are peeling off and getting married, and this whole social structure that they built up, this house of cards, is crumbling.
It's falling down.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And they're falling behind. As my sister says, you know, because my sister is a good deal older than I am, and she got married years and years and years ago. And she said, Lisa, she said, back in my day, she said, when you were out of college, you kind of got married, because if you didn't, you lost. There weren't all these other options of all these social circles for you to be in, you know. So we realized that you had to kind of start moving in that direction. Otherwise, you would be left behind, in a sense.
Right. And now it's sort of, for some people, something, I guess, that, you know, we've heard everyone gets married later, and, you know, the average age of first marriage is now 28, which in a lot of ways could be wonderful if we use those 20-something years to be smarter about who we're going to settle down with. That would be the upside. The downside of it can be is that people use those years to not think about relationships because they feel like, well, that's something for later. And then what happens is the 30s come around and they marry whoever they happen to be dating at the moment. It's really not any more of a thoughtful decision than it would have been 5 years earlier because they haven't been thinking that their 20-something relationships mattered.
Yeah. Okay, so we need to help some people here because some people probably have a box of tissues in front of them at this point and just feel like something has gone awry. I love how you talk about, you give the illustration of really what you describe as a course correction in the sense of a plane taking off from New York City, a decision that you make in, you know, a number of decisions, what you choose to do will either land you in San Diego or Seattle. So talk, Meg, to that 20-something, you know, 30-something maybe even, who is like, something that I'm doing right now has me stalled out. I'm just, I know I'm not where I need to be. And now I'm fearful that I'm not going to be where I want to be in my 30s. What can they do? What are some practical things that young adults can do today to start moving them in a direction that really is going to increase their capital, get them where they want to be, and really add value to their experience?
Okay. So what that would be really across the book, across the different domains, is to realize that now is the time to take your life seriously. Now is the time to say, what kind of person am I dating? Is this person, the way a 20-something actually put it to me is that someone said to her, imagine if you kept living your life exactly as it is right now, would you like where you'd be 3 years from now? And if that's not the case, then something needs to change. Maybe for you it's, I need to start dating people that would actually be good lifelong partners for me. Or maybe it's, I need to get out of this sort of easy clock-in, clock-out job and think about a job that I might enjoy and that might actually take me somewhere. Maybe it's, I need to get control of my emotions or my drinking or my eating or whatever the case is. The 20s are no time to sit around with a box of tissues. In fact, whatever it is you know you need a course correction on, now is the easiest time to make that course correction. So the book is actually an extremely optimistic, inspirational book, and the message is that this is a developmental sweet spot. This is the time to change.
Yeah, and it is just really great. Again, the book is The Defining Decade by Meg Jay, and she also has great things to say in here that we didn't even touch on yet today about studies on cohabitation and trending kind of that you know, falling into these relationships. I think you alluded to it a little bit, Meg, where finally it's a sliding rather than deciding kind of situation. And all of a sudden you wake up one day and not only do you share a rent or a mortgage, but a dog, and then you feel stuck, and just a lot of decisions that have come out of that. So definitely, just we appreciate, Meg, you kind of putting into words and really from your clinical expertise and beyond illustrating some of this, because I think a lot of times it can seem a little voodoo-ish to our generation and we feel like we can't pinpoint, like, is this really practical? Does this really mean, you know, is this really a cultural or generational trend? So again, the defining decade. Meg J., thank you so much for joining us today on The Boundless Show to talk through some of this. And hopefully we'll see on our blog, because we'll blog about this, some determination from some 20-somethings and beyond to kind of take that responsibility, take ownership of themselves, and move forward.
Great. It was great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Potential sex addict, just living for the thrill, creating wounds that I thought for sure would never heal. I got a hole in my soul this world could never fill, but yet and still I lie in lust like it will, and yet and still I'm knowing this is not your will, following my way, living like you wasn't real. But see, I knew the truth, yeah, I had tasted proof, but knowing God is something that I kept concealed. See, the world was pushing, yeah, the world was lying, selling fairy tales. Yep, yep, I was buying, but my soul was crying. Friends thought I was flying, cause outside I'm a lion, but inside I'm dying.
Well, hello, everyone. We are opening up this week's inbox, and the wonderful and illustrious John Thomas is on the line with me. Hey, John.
Oh, Lisa, you're so kind. Hey, how are you?
Well, I'm doing well. I'm just glad that, you know, you're not too big for your britches and you're still willing to hang out with us from time to time.
Absolutely.
Very excited about that.
I will never be too big for my britches to hang out with you guys.
That is good. Well, that is a very good thing, because we have a question for you to answer this week. We tend to throw a lot of the guys' ones at you, as we do on the site as well. So this one's a good time and money one. So, and it's actually pretty short. This guy wants to know, what should men and women do with all the time and money we have to spare during our single years? I'm not. Do all of us have time and money to spare? I'm going to say, okay. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think there's a little bit more. There's just a little more flexibility. How does that sound?
Yeah, maybe. Okay, that's good.
You're still wondering about that,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
Well, I think Lisa, you know, you have a little grin when you hear that question, because I think you've answered it well in your life. And but there are those who maybe need a little wisdom in this department. And I think there's a couple of verses that has informed me a lot with questions about the seasons of life. And it's that little passage in Ephesians chapter 5, the verses 15 and 16 that say, "Look carefully then how you walk or how you live, not as unwise but as wise, making the best use of the time, because the days are evil." And then it goes on to say, "Therefore don't be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is." And I always look at that passage when I think about different seasons of life, and the word time there really does mean season or moment. It doesn't actually mean, you know, a quantitative time, but more of a quality of time. And so really what the Lord is saying there is, the actual words being used there is redeem the time or buy the time. In other words, don't waste the moment. And so the answer to the question, this is what he's asking, how do I not waste these years? Mm-hmm. Because the single years can be wasted. I think a lot of us can even look at our own portions of our single years anyways and say, oh, I wish I had been a little wiser in those days. So here's how I would say don't waste it. I would say begin in those years to develop the kind of life that you want to have for the rest of your life. In other words, when then marriage comes along, should the Lord bring that, or should kids come along, or whatever comes along, if something changes in your marital status, that the way that you live your life because of the habits and the lifestyle that you've created doesn't really have to change all that much, no matter what comes next. So these are great years to be building the kind of foundation that you want your life to be on forever. What you don't want is to not be doing that during this time and just say, I'm going to put that off until I really need it. And so marriage comes along, for instance, or kids come along, and you haven't developed very good kingdom living ideas, and you're trying to develop the foundation while you're building the building, which is not easy to do. These are the years to lay the kind of foundation that you want to have for the rest of your life. So what I suggest is I suggest looking at your life and saying, how do I develop the Sermon on the Mount lifestyle? How do I develop kingdom thinking with my time, with my treasure, and with my talents, so that when this season changes, I really don't have to think very differently? So I would say to this guy, look at your life right now and ask, how is your time being used from a kingdom standpoint? And how is your money being used from a kingdom standpoint? And how are your gifts and talents being used from a kingdom standpoint? Are you spending all of these things on yourself? Because if you are, if that's the habit that you're developing now, it will be really hard to change when the season changes. So think kingdom in every season of your life, and then it's just details after that. Buy up the time and make the most of it. So you're sitting here with a little more time than maybe you will when you're married and with kids. So like you've done, Lisa, you've really invested your life in the kingdom. And you've really looked at your life and your time and said, you know, here's the 24 hours that I have. So is it going to be spent on me, or is it going to be spent on maybe what the Lord would have? As spouses come into your life and as kids come into your life, that 24 hours gets used up in other areas. And so what we want to say then is, we don't want to change our mentality when that comes. We still want to be thinking kingdom.
Yeah, that's good.
And so, I don't know. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that's good. And I think it's so easy to succumb to the creep, though. I mean, I just think of, you know, myself 15 years ago and how I could move everything I owned in my car.
Sure.
And, you know, as I've accumulated things and been shackled to things and a home and different, you know, it's just, I think I still have to be vigilant in saying, am I really maximizing what I have, my time, my attention, my possessions? You know, so I think, like you said, when you have a family, you're only going to have more time and attention to devote to that. So you need to free yourself up as much as you can now.
Yeah.
So,
you know, and seasons come and go, but in every season, at least for me, I want to say, how can I be spent for the kingdom in this season? Mm-hmm. Because eternity is the thing I'm living for. You know, this life is going to come and go so fast. And so I ask that question as a single. I ask that question now as a married man who's a father. And hopefully I'll still be asking that question as my kids grow up and the nest empties and my wife and I look at each other and we say, what now? I hope that we have developed the kind of lifestyle where we say, well, of course, what now? The kingdom, that's what now. Mm-hmm. And we give the same answer in every season. Now, I understand how singles can be taken advantage of, and everybody thinks they've got all this spare time and change to do everything. And I'm not in favor of just, you know, hassling the singles to do all the work that nobody else wants to do. At the same time, though, I do think that singles need to be asking the same question that married people need to be asking and that empty nesters need to be asking, and that is, how do we not waste the moment that we're in right now in terms of the kingdom?
Yeah.
Well, which was the big theme for Piper's book, Don't Waste Your Life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he opens the book, or somewhere in the book, he gives an illustration of this retired couple that have lived their life so that they can retire and go collect shells on the beach. And we're thinking, you know, we're going to face Jesus and show him our shell collection.
Yeah.
We don't want to do that. We right. do not want to do that. We want to face him and him say, well done in every season. Good job.
Okay. Well, good thoughts, John Thomas. Again, folks, if you want to write to us with a question of your own or to respond to this one or share something from your own experience, write to us at editor@boundless.org or comment on our podcast post below so we can hear from you. And we will go ahead and make sure to connect with you on that. We always love hearing people's stories and how they're putting these things into practice, because some of you have walked this road already. That is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.